Hello, everyone. I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season 5 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today, we have a very special guest in the Archive Fever studio, an archive addict who comes to us all the way from Boolu, also known as Perth in Western Australia. Dr. Nadia Rook is a historian of settler colonialism who completed a PhD at La Trobe University and later worked at the University of Western Australia. These days, Nadia bridges two worlds. She's an acclaimed scholar, the author of many works of academic history, but she's also a prolific poet, a creative writer whose poetry explores the histories and present of colonisation and asks questions about how history gets made and told. Like other poets we've interviewed on Archive Fever, including Natalie Harkin and Tony Birch, Nadia uses poetry to interrogate the colonial archive, though in Nadia's case she does this from the perspective of a white settler. Her first poetry collection, Boots, was published by UWA in 2020, and in 2022 she published her follow-up, Second Fleet Baby, with Fremantle Press. Nadia, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thanks so much, Eve. It's so wonderful to be here with you both today.
So, Nadia, we'll come back to talk about your more recent poetry work in a moment. But first, let's go back to the origins of your interest in history and the past. How did you first get bitten by the research bug?
Yeah, interesting question to think about. I do have a very vivid memory. I don't know if it was a research bug, but it was a moment of, I think, big historical consciousness. Mm. When I was around 8 years old, I found a horseshoe in the backyard of my mum's house, a rusty horseshoe. And I asked my mum, where did this come from, this horseshoe? She said, people who lived here some stage before must have had a horse. And my imagination went crazy thinking about who had lived in this house before us in the olden days, how long had the house I lived in been a house. And I think I held on to that horseshoe. I think I have even a poem about it in my first collection, this rusty horseshoe. And I guess that also is something about the power of place and also of objects to hold history and to be able to trigger these moments of intense connection. So that would be my first, I think, memory of that connection with the past.
And how did you travel from that moment at 8 years old to then going on to do a PhD in history?
Yeah, my gosh. I did study history in high school. I had an excellent history teacher who was very loved at Melbourne University, and then did a PhD at La Trobe. And I guess that must have been the time I was burning with the madness of an archive fever, because I ended up looking at criminal court cases in Victoria over one decade. I'd planned to do 2 decades, but one decade involved looking at about 1,400 trials, which I made a database of, and I transcribed every case where an interpreter was involved because I was very interested in the politics of race and language mm-hmm. in the lead up to Federation. So I think I spent over 3 years going to the public records office in Victoria a few times a week. So it was a long, slow burning fever.
And what kept you so captivated by that collection? What kept you going back day after day for that 3 years?
I don't know. I'm trying to write about it at the moment. In fact, I think it was some sort of steely determination, really. But it was very captivating because the law was so interested in every intimate detail of people's lives, insofar as it was relevant to the legal proceedings, but also beyond that, these police and questioning officers had a deep interest in the witnesses who were giving depositions, but also it seemed as though these legal authorities were using their questioning powers as an opportunistic way to gain even more intimate details in ways that were very racialized. So through these archive, these amazing stories of the social life of 1890s Melbourne emerged, you know, dramatic stories about crime and relationships and the struggles of being a migrant and the struggles of being surveilled emerged. It also changed the way that I saw Melbourne and Victoria because these stories were set in place and I would leave the archives in North Melbourne and then walk up through the Hoddle Grid with new stories in my head and reimagining Melbourne. So I guess there was probably something in that that kept me going back for more as well.
Nadia, full disclosure, I shared an office next to yours when you were doing that PhD, and the thing that so struck me about your research at the time that I was so fascinated by was that you were dealing with a paper archive in that you were actually looking at these court transcripts from the 19th century, but you were doing it with an eye to how that Melbourne that you've just described sounded. So it was the orality of the experience of living in 1890s Melbourne that you were particularly sifting through the archives to find. And I know that shaped the way that I started thinking about the work that I was doing, about what did that landscape that those people who you're reading about inhabit sound like. So tell us about how an historian trained in looking at paper documents and material objects, as you've described the horseshoe so beautifully, how did that segue for you into a more kind of linguistic or oral soundscape of the past?
That's a great question. And it did take some thinking about to arrive at looking at that archive, criminal records, with the intent to find out more about linguistic history. Of course, law is a thoroughly linguistic institution, but there wasn't much sound recording technologies in those days. And of course, historians are used to reading against the grain, but there was really a lot of, I think, two things, a kind of assumption. Okay, of course there were sounds in the past. And if we think about if there was a horse going along this street, we would have heard the sound of horse hooves. So a kind of basic assumption that this acoustic past exists, this language scape exists, and so how can we then use textual records with a kind of activated imagination to listen to the past? And also I think it helped in that I had had an embodied experience of Melbourne as a very multilingual city. I'd been working as an ESL teacher for a company on Collins Street, and I was kind of literally tuned in to the ways in which language you heard would depend on where you were, which building you were in, which side of a bench you were on in the city. And as you move through the city, you hear different languages. So I think having that as an embodied experience recently before I started my PhD, you know, and I know we're not supposed to project the present back onto the past, it was an experience in the present that I think gave me the permission to insist that this linguistic past existed and there were ways in which that could be reconstructed. And so especially law, in order to be universal, law had to include everybody. Therefore, it had to employ interpreters and bring in speakers of all different languages and at least pretend it could hear those languages translated into English. But yeah, perhaps it was, in one word, imagination that really enabled that.
And having an ear to the past, it seems to me, also allowed you to include a multiracial and multilingual past, as you've said, but that allowed for the possibility of including more actors than had generally been
included in the cast of characters of who was part of this colonial Melbourne. And I remember being very fascinated by your research into the Indian community in Melbourne in the 1890s. Can you tell us a bit about that community? Because, you know, now at La Trobe University, we have a huge Indian student population. We tend to think of that as quite a recent phenomenon, but your research suggests otherwise.
Yeah, so there were two official court interpreters, a Chinese interpreter, perhaps unsurprisingly, because people of Chinese descent were the largest non-European population at that time, but also an official Indian interpreter, as he was called, although South Asian, I guess, might be the more apt term for today. But, I mean, it wasn't really my discovery. Of course, the descendants of South Asians who had come, some in as early as the 1850s on the goldfields, but definitely there was this wave of immigration in the 1880s at a time when Victoria and India were colonial cousins. There was this strong imperial oceanic shipping routes and connection there. So it did, again, make me see, especially that area around Little Lonsdale and Lonsdale Street was a really vibrant South Asian hub. And in fact, in the debates about federation and the formation of the White Australian policy, Indian British subjects loomed so large in the imagination, debatably much larger than people of Chinese descent, because they were British subjects and it was more on your conscience to discriminate against them. So, yeah.
Nadia, you've spoken about how you used your imagination to kind of recreate the soundscape of colonial Melbourne, and that same imagination has also given rise to some really wonderful poetry over the last five or so years. You've published two works of poetry, and I think what is most exciting for me about that shift is these poems are deeply historical. They seem as much as part of your historian's work as your more scholarly academic journal articles. So can you tell us about making that shift from kind of conventional academic publishing in peer-reviewed journals to a more creative writer kind of telling history through the medium of poetry?
Yeah, and I mean, it's been so exciting to me. I'm still feel so grateful every day that I gave myself permission to make that shift. Although I did, of course, use my imagination before I began writing poetry almost daily around 6 years ago. On another hand, I did have to suppress my imagination during my PhD research. You know, my supervisor would warn me against speculation and going too far away from what was explicit in the record. So really soon after I finished my PhD, I just started writing, and I creatively poetry, some terrible historical fiction short stories and things. But I had so many images in my head, so many sort of intuitions about how different stories played out that I had just seen fragments of in the archive, that it felt that in the creative work I could let my mind run freer. The effect is to communicate, I guess, what's unsaid in the records. But for me, I think it was just I needed a different space to process what I'd learned and to connect with it, because some of these historical figures were so alive to me and their history was so alive. And also that experience in the archive was also exhausting and I needed nourishment. And I did write a poem also called Archival Saturation about feeling that maybe the fervor had burnt out and I needed someone to press a cold compressed to my head for a while, more sort of feeling. So, you know, all that other stuff around researching, the emotional stuff, the personal stuff.
The process.
Yeah, the process. The journal articles don't give a lot of space for, I think.
And I do particularly love those poems about the processes of history and the politics of history and the limits of a kind of Western style capital H history. I was wondering if you could read one of those poems for us today, the one called Movements Beyond History.
Sure, I'd love to. I was subject to gravity, planet pulled to sun, writer pulled to power, historian bound by authority. See how I tied footnotes around my ankles and pretended it was still easy to walk. only kicking off my references and singing from the soles of my feet to the tips of my mind could return me to the stories I knew just a few days before this all began. A time when my legs flew higher than my waist without needing to question who would verify the height of my kick. Having met Europe at the bottom of so many pages, I finally understand that I too need release. Go on, I dare you to imagine. It feels like becoming airborne, an illusory absence of weight.
It's such a wonderful poem, Nadia. I'm wondering if there are people listening out there who are historians or other academics who have a yearning to kick off the shackles of footnotes. Do you have any advice for that process? I mean, I think that fear guides a lot of what we do as academics, fear of the response that we're going to get from the institution if we push the boundaries beyond the trappings of the discipline. How would you advise someone who might be hankering for that kind of release that you describe so wonderfully in that poem?
I think you just have to give yourself permission. For me, I feel life is too short to just stay within the conventions. But also, I guess, in a positive way, there is so much to be gained. If you want to be creative, or if you feel something bubbling within you that wants to be creative, that there is so much to be gained by just giving yourself permission to just have a play or experiment with how you might do that, even with research that you've already done. Because to me, it's about the quality of connection that you have with that research or with that knowledge or with the past. I heard someone say the other day that a poem knows more than the poet. And I feel like there's something in that creative work, it goes to other dimensions, whether it's emotional or personal or spiritual, and that you don't need to apologize for that. Just for me, even just recognizing that history is a specific culture that has its roots in especially German and Danish men in the 19th century decided that we had to write rigorous footnoted essays in order for our work to be different to fiction. And just because those men decided that in the 19th century, does not mean that that is the best way to connect to the past. And the more I think about that, I think it's just how histories happen, that we do history this way. It could be other ways. Your poem that you write today might be footnoted one day and become authoritative, or it might not, but does that matter? To me, then, if you write a story that does something for you, that serves you, it will probably serve other people as well. And that's what I've learned through trial and error. So there might be an institutional cost if you write creatively all the time. The institution may not value it. But, you know, a lot of people, including yourselves, are fighting for creative works to have that recognition. I know at UWA there was people in the English department done a great job fighting for creative works to get the same number of points as were attributed points for outcomes, etc. So I really do think that comes back to that giving permission, having a play. I've done things like take fragments of journal articles and rearrange them on the page to form a poem and see how it looks. For me, that looked so unsatisfying as a way to communicate something I thought was really meaningful that I just kept playing or just allowed the fullness of yourself, I think, instead of just your scholarly self, the fullness of yourself to write a story about what it is that you know.
Yeah, don't get us started on the topic of the undervaluing of what's called non-traditional research outcomes by the institutions in the Australian Research Council. Actually, we've discovered that Archive Fever podcast has been footnoted by a couple of academics now, which all feels very weird and meta.
So we're legit scholarship. Nadia, you just mentioned, you know, the importance of bringing the fullness of yourself to poetry. I love that phrase. And part of the fullness of yourself that comes across in your poetry is your embodiment, your experience in place on stolen land, and your experience with motherhood. As I was reading those kind of poems which center your own experience and subjectivity, I kept kind of thinking about those German men who founded the historical profession in the 19th century and their insistence that historians be like scientists and be kind of objective and dispassionate and disavow their subjectivity. And so I wondered if, by so emphasising your subjectivity in these historical poems, are you kind of speaking back to those men in a way?
I am, yeah. And a lot more consciously in my second book than in my first. But yes, and it's a fairly well-trodden feminist praxis to write from experience and from the body. But yes, absolutely. And I just do not think that history is a science. I think it's an art for me, and it's just story. Mm. And it's also the experience of teaching and spending time in Indigenous studies where the point A is, what's your standpoint in this place? So I'm a cis white settler woman living on Wajak land, am I a mother, etc. So that's the starting point. And then all those labels are sort of shorthand for the longer hand of like, well, what's my story, which is what's my history as well. Yeah, so there's a lot of ethical imperatives to me to write from the body. And also, yes, exactly, that history was founded through the desire that it be recognised as a science, because the end point is objective knowledge. But if you think that the end point is connection or healing or self-understanding, it's just a different ballgame. And for me, that involves writing my own self into the story as the story, and just, in a sense, I give up a lot of authority potentially. It's very different to publish a poetry collection to a monograph, for instance. So I'm very aware that I have maybe given up a lot of authority, but this is a kind of authority I'm comfortable with as a woman historian. That's sort of where I feel most well placed to just offer a smaller story which may link to larger things, but is not the only story, isn't the authoritative story. So my Second Fleet Baby talks a lot about convict women. It's not my expertise, convict history. I guess I know a bit about it, having been around Australian historians for 20 years, but the only authority I have to talk about that history is because my own maternal ancestor was a convict woman. And through that personal connection, I feel, okay, I can give myself permission to tell some of these stories. And it doesn't matter if there are 100 other historians out there who know more than me, or there's that, I guess, in short, a kind of an attempt at a decolonial feminist praxis.
Nadia, you've described an intellectual trajectory that saw you going from a PhD student who was very rooted in the colonial archive, although coming at it from a really interesting and against the grain perspective, to somebody who is now flipping the bird at the profession. I wonder whether that, you said that you burned through the archives, you know, that fever almost burned you out at the time. Do you still feel like you have that addictive pull to the archive itself, or has your actual attraction somehow diminished from the creative place that you now come from?
Yeah, that's probably very perceptive. Yeah, I would say that it's definitely diminished because, I mean, there are lots of different archives too. Some are more fun than others, right? And that was a particularly heavy archive, and asking questions about race in the 19th century is a heavy topic. But yes, I approach it very differently, and now with much more self-care as well, because now I feel that it's almost a little bit terrifying that we just send our students into these archives, which, you know, I know you've spoken to Natalie Harkin, who wrote so beautifully around questions of trauma in archives and re-traumatization. And so I still am very interested in connecting with the past and restoring the past, but just doing that in slower ways, and I'm happier with fragments now. And I'm also really interested in, I guess you could still call it archives, but, you know, reading the landscape or accessing family memories or looking for places other than especially government archives for archives or for records or for traces of the past. And I think there's something in that that might be a bit slower or a bit more, well, I guess I want to be nourished. I want to be nourished by the way that I connect with the past. It was really interesting when I taught a third year history methods class that, you know, that 90% of the students, when asked how do you connect with history, talked about touching bricks or touching stone or seeing a building or something like in the outdoors or, you know, as an experience. And I think two people in that class mentioned books, and one of them was a history book. I think it's so interesting that most people connect with the past in ways that other than by going to archives and sitting there for days or years or decades. And those are valid. And why do we as historians like neglect or diminish those sorts of extra archival sources of the past?
Because of the German men.
Yes, because of the hierarchies of authority.
Yeah. Cast a long shadow.
Yeah, they have a lot to answer for. We're going to have to begin wrapping up, Nadia, but I want to ask one question. We've spoken a lot about, I suppose, how your move into poetry has shifted your relationship to the history discipline and historical consciousness and history writing. But I kind of want to flip that a bit and think about, I suppose, your relationship to the poetry world, because it seems to me, from my fairly limited knowledge of what's being written in the poetry world in this continent, that there is a kind of broader turn, like a kind of archival turn or historical turn. We have people like Natalie Harkin, Tony Birch, Elfie Shiosaki, and others kind of all using poetry to delve into the traumas of colonial history and colonial archive. How do you see your work in relation to that kind of broader poetic movement towards history?
Yeah, I mean, that's been hugely influential, the rise and rise of First Nations archival poetics. And I feel like we're sitting here in the kind of orbit of Tony Birch. The fact that there has been a poet historian around who's shown ways to write history through poetry. So, yeah, lots of poets are now using archives in creative ways, and often to tell their own histories as well. And I think it also goes to that question of what for, what's the engagement with the archive for? Mm. And I think when you are using an archive creatively, you're in control. Maybe you're in control of its hold on you, or you can reinterpret its hold on you. So it's a really exciting time for me, and it's really exciting to me if historians listen to especially First Nations archival poetics, because I think they show the way to engage with archives in ways that are ethical and also sustainable, and do sort of make us question those perhaps outdated questions of authority or cultures of authority that we live with. So to me, they're not so separate, the poetry and the history. There's a lot of conversations happening, and there's a lot of similar interests in terms of understanding colonialism, understanding what it means to write as a settler in the presence of Indigenous sovereignty. I think the conversations in poetry happen quicker because it's quicker to publish creative essays and poetry. They come out quicker than journal articles come out so slowly. There's a lot you can say in a poem, so I find that there's a lot of energy for me in engaging with poetry that feeds into more formal scholarship and vice versa.
Thanks. We're going to have to wrap it up, Nadia, and it does sound like you are a recovering archive addict, if not completely dry. But I would like to ask you one final question that we do ask people here in Archives Anonymous. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd be willing to share with us?
A dirty archive secret. I feel like I shouldn't talk about, you know, smuggling food in, because the archives make me so hungry.
Can we use that as the title of the episode? Archives make me so hungry.
They make me so hungry. Well, I'm really interested in my grandfather's shed as an archive at the moment, and I found a literally dirty old tool that my great-grandfather used to build some of the bluestone gutters around Ballarat in the early 20th century, and I am quietly writing some creative histories of Melbourne and including the history of bluestone. So I've become a bit obsessed with this, some sort of cross between chisel and a hammer, and do have dreams of kind of perhaps reenacting my great-grandfather's use of this tool, and that's my now non-secret.
Glad to hear that you're still obsessed.
I look forward to the reenactment. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Nadia. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. To learn more about Nadia's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Nadi Rook or on Instagram at Nadia Rook. And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve Rees.
Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3 and 4 of Archive Fever via our website archivefeverpod.com.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri and Bunurong land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
That was part of this kind of negotiating through iterative consent how that part of the story would be told, and to embody that and to embody who I actually am and everything that comes with in the final film. Mm.